This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the Moment and Mobility series. The series is hosted by the New Books Network in association with the Mobilities and Methods Lab at the University of Illinois at Chicago. The Mobilities and Methods Lab, a New Books Network partnership, provides a platform for authors, readers, and their interlocutors to engage closely with questions of mobility and movement. My name is Aliza Arıca. Today, I'm joined by Ziad Fahmi, a professor of Modern Middle East History at Cornell University's Department of Near Eastern Studies. We'll be talking about his book, Street Sounds, Listening to Everyday Life in Modern Egypt, published by Stanford University Press in 2020. Thank you very much, Dr. Fahmi, for joining us today.
Thank you, Aliza. Thanks for inviting me.
So how did you conceive of this project, and particularly, how did you decide to home in on sound?
So the initial idea for the book, for Street Sounds, came to me roughly around in early 2011 or so, as I was finishing the final revisions of my previous book, Ordinary Egyptians. Because I was dealing in that book, in the first book, primarily with recorded music, vernacular theater, zagel, which is colloquial poetry, and other oral sources, I became more consciously aware, really, of the importance of sound and listening to not only the project at hand, but more broadly to history writing in general. So it really became obvious to me at the time that more sounded histories of Egypt and the Middle East were sorely needed. As often happens, sometimes sort of good luck intervened for me. And in 2012, the Society of Humanities at Cornell had its theme was sound, culture, theory, practice, and politics. And I applied for this fellowship. And my fellowship at the Society for that year was really, really instrumental in sort of exposing me to sound studies in general as a field. And it was very important in sort of forging my ideas about sounds and soundscapes. And I started thinking about examining the soundscapes of Egypt in the early 20th century. And after that, I started, I wrote some grant proposals and started my project.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And it seems like a rather unorthodox project for a history book, if I may. And building on that, in the introduction, you underline the importance of listening to the historical resources. And, I found that very provocative especially in terms of methods and methodology. So I'm wondering, what does listening to the historical resources look like methodologically? And, you know, especially when you translate this into a book, when you write about sound, how does one write a history that one can listen to rather than just read?
This, in a way, for many people, seems a bit counterintuitive, but it's really a lot simpler than it seems. To paraphrase Mark Smith, who is a sensory historian that specializes in 19th century American history, sensory history is really, it's easy to do. It's low hanging fruit. It doesn't really require special archives or actual listening to historical recordings. Though if you happen to work, of course, during the second half of the 20th century, and you have some of these recordings, that would be helpful, of course. But sensory history is really ubiquitous. It's in all of the sources that historians have been using for generations. So a historian just needs to attune themselves to the multiple sensory references that are literally everywhere, in the archives, as well as in newspapers, memoirs, travel journals, etc. So all texts have sensory references and make sensory observations. Of course, human beings typically use all five senses to describe the world around them, and often will relay that description in the historical text that they produce. So the real trick is to be sensitive to these sensory data and make use of them in the historical analysis. So people will relay how they, you know, heard the world around them, and how smell, touch, and taste informed how they experience the world. So to me, at least, what makes these written sensory experiences important is that they almost always describe firsthand, close up, street level, intimate experiences. So in order for a person to actually listen to a conversation or to describe an olfactory experience, they have to be sitting or standing nearby. So I literally have yet to find a source that doesn't really refer to the senses in some form. Because, you know, we live in a multisensory world, and so did the people of the past. And writing a history that attempts to describe this multisensory environment can only enrich and nuance our understanding of the past.
So in a way, writing a sensory history is more of being attuned to,
absolutely,
you know, what is there.
Absolutely. It's more about sort of picking up our radar a bit and being sensitive to all of these sensory inputs that are there in the very same text that we've been looking at all along.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's wonderful. And, you know, you touched upon how, in a way, you know, ordinary people describe those sensory experiences. But in your book, we see a lot of, you know, like newspaper articles or official documents that reference senses as well, which I found very intriguing. It's a different lens to look at those sorts of documents, right?
Absolutely. And that was always part of the conversation. And generally in the public sphere among intellectuals and especially the Egyptian middle classes. And this is one of the arguments that I make in the book, that especially when you're using a sensory history in a particular way, it makes it easier to get to especially middle-class construction and middle-class formation, because often the middle classes use the senses in order to differentiate themselves from the masses. And in doing so, they, of course, from their own perspective, they describe the sounds and the smells and the tastes of the streets. So you definitely get at it from this perspective, and it gives you a more embodied way to examine class formation.
Yeah, that's great. And, you know, one, like you mentioned, the class formation aspect. And another, you know, very powerful aspect of your book relates to modernization and state power. And you highlight the dominant prioritization of sites in theories that deal with this. So how does shifting the emphasis from sight to sound expand our understanding of modernization as state power? And, you know, particularly, I wonder how Egyptian cities provide us insight into this broader question.
Yeah. So as you alluded to, often the theoretical frameworks for really understanding modern state power invoke a distant and strictly visual understanding of power. And so this bird's eye view almost exclusively focuses on the plans, the maps, and the so-called gaze of the state. But when we get to the street level, by definition, it is a more sort of embodied affair where all the senses are involved. This obviously applies to the actual realities on the ground with the actual enforcement, if it does take place by the state police, for example. But often there's also sort of a multi-sensory vocabulary that is also reflected in the discourses that deal with the streets and with everyday people, like we talked about in the previous question. So, for example, public noise was usually perceived as dangerously chaotic and socially disruptive, and it was vulgarized as culturally backward, except, of course, when that noise was produced by the state. When it was invoked as a part of a sort of a socially broad nationalist mobilization. So with few exceptions, especially when dealing with discussions about modernity, the Egyptian media sort of perpetrated a silencing campaign, really targeting the urban masses. So the sounds of beggars, street vendors, entertainers, and a host of itinerant poor were especially maligned. And the state was often mobilized to regulate and silence the streets. Also, as I explored throughout the book, the modern transformation of Egypt's street environment, from electric lighting in the streets to automobile traffic and the growth of a sort of a modern mass transportation network, greatly impacted daily life in an obviously embodied and multisensory way. And that dramatically changed how the streets functioned, felt, and sounded to ordinary people. So I guess to reiterate, a sensory approach to the sources sort of reveals a great deal more about what happened at the ground level, among the thousands of ordinary people sort of commuting, walking, shopping, selling their goods and services, etc.
Yeah, and not to give away too much from the book, but I was wondering if you could give us a few examples about the relationship between these new sort of technologies like electricity or modes of transportation and those shifts in everyday lives.
Yeah, I mean, you wouldn't really have a regular nightlife, for example, without electricity. The building of effective street lights, but also the lighting of theaters, and eventually, of course, the creation of movie theaters, the use of loudspeakers, without this taking shape, that didn't really exist, and that allowed people to stay up a little bit later at night, for example. And of course, that has a lot of sensory implications and noise implications as well. All the new transportation networks that were developed, especially the tramway, which I talk about a lot more in the book, dramatically changed how people commuted to work. But also at the same time, it allowed people to use the tramway for a variety of other reasons. And so street hawkers, for example, made use of the tramways quite effectively in a way that tramways weren't really intended to be used. They would sell their goods, of course, in the tram, and they, without, you know, paying for the ticket, they would go in and out and tram surf, if you will. So a lot of those changes were intended to be used in a particular way, but everyday people use them for their own purposes.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, that's wonderful. I love that your book also shows that state power is never omnipotent. And, you know, you also mentioned that ordinary people find ways to reclaim the city in return. So I have two questions based on that. First off, and maybe this is a bit about your previous project, how do you define, you know, ordinary people, which is a term you use a lot in the book? And then what insights does a history of mundane street sounds offer in terms of how ordinary people reclaim cities or appropriate space?
To me, it's pedestrians, it's street hawkers. It's the one thing that really tied this book together is an examination of street life. So anyone who makes use of the streets to make a living and to engage with society, to me, is someone that is integral to ordinary life in Egyptian society. And what was the second part of your question?
The second part is that, what are some ways in which, you know, ordinary people appropriate cities? And, you know, how does a history of a mundane street sounds help us sort of see that?
Yeah, they appropriate it by using them, by making use of them in their everyday lives. And as I alluded to, often that's it's for their own purposes. And in Egypt in particular, where, and that's certainly still is the case, there's a very large sort of informal economy, and people have to rely on the streets to make a living. Regardless of what laws are being set up by the state in order to control the streets, people make use of it in order to first make a living, but also for everyday celebrations and mourning, etc. So often Egyptian weddings and funerals take place in the streets, for example, despite the fact that often that's discouraged by the state. Again, there's always this tug of war over control of the streets, and the state often wants to regulate street hawkers, street celebrations. In different times in history, of course, there are curfews. There's ways to try to control the streets, but almost always people resist that. And often these encounters are very much enmeshed in sort of a sensory history. And that's the one way, or one of the ways I think that historians can get to this. Because by listening in to the sources and by examining references to a lot of what was happening on a sensory level, immediately you come closer to the street level.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And, you know, I just really admire your embodied approach to history. And speaking of embodiment, I'm wondering if you could speak a bit more to the gendered aspect of your book. Particularly, you know, how does an embodied approach to history illuminate the role that gender plays in these everyday appropriation of streets?
Yes. So a sensory historical approach really lends itself, as I just talked about, to sort of street level analysis and details what some historians have suspected all along, that women in 19th and early 20th century Egypt were always an integral part of the Egyptian public sphere. And you can see that when in reading the book by simply zooming in and listening in to the streets themselves. You hear the sounds of women who are part of this street life, and the female street hawkers and merchants and beggars and Quran reciters, but also female shoppers, pedestrians, and commuters. The sensory approach also in many ways counters the common misconception that there was sort of a distinctive split between the private and public sphere. And so as I demonstrate throughout the book, walls were literally sort of paper thin, and windows, doors, and balconies were almost always open and acted as sort of sensory portals for conversations and other interactions. Rooftops, courtyards, neighborhood alleys also function as these liminal spaces that were neither private nor public. And allowed for conversations, all kinds of interactions. And when you use a sensory approach, you really hone in on all of this. Until, for example, the 1930s and 40s, there was both, class and gender mixing anxieties over people's interactions in the streets, at least in the Egyptian media, maybe until the 30s. This was really especially true in relation to popular public expressions of joy during traditional sort of music-infused celebrations. For example, ululations that take place at weddings, births, and circumcisions, and so forth, were frowned upon by the middle classes and the press, but yet they were prevalent throughout the Egyptian streets. Almost always these were female voices, and so when you were listening in, that sort of changes the dynamics both of what we considered private and public, but also it shows that women were not just visible, but they were certainly audible throughout the Egyptian streets. This was, of course, also the case in traditional sort of funerals, with somber chants and shrieks and wails and deaths and funerals. Many of these traditions were continually attacked by both religious and secular conservatives. Most of these critiques were sensory. So this highlights the sensory aspects even more. As often they admonish the loudness and musicality and the general embodiment of this gender mixing that takes place during these events. I think the sensory approach really highlights these a lot of these early 20th century public female voices.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And, you know, as you mentioned a little bit, it's also a good sort of window into different kinds of conflicts within a society in the everyday. That's fascinating. So I was wondering, how do you see your work in conversation with broader studies of sensorium? And, you know, by that I mean not just history, but across humanities and social sciences, as well as within the Middle East and beyond.
Yeah, I can't really like fully answer this question yet, I think, since the impact of the book really will not be known for at least probably a couple of years. And I'm shying away from really just maybe exaggerating its importance. This is a novel approach for a historian of modern Egypt. I'm sort of treading carefully. Also, at the same time, I I don't necessarily consider this book as entirely sort of a sensory studies project. And I mean, it is somewhat, but it's to me, it's more of a social, cultural history of everyday people that actively and purposely uses a sensory approach. And I chose it not just because it was new, but because I thought that it was the best tool available to do the job for sort of an examination of street life. So I hope that both historians of the senses and historians of the Middle East can make use of this book as an example of how to study class and class formation, as well as one way of studying street life. I don't know what impact it will have in a broader sense. I'm hoping that those that study sensory history in other areas will find value in my work. But again, I guess I'm sort of waiting and anticipating that there'll be more connections with sensory historians and others in the future.
Yeah, that's very fair.
There is the train. I love it. It sounds like it's part of a movie. I think the train is beeping in approval. I think they're sounding the horn in approval. They're like soundscapes.
Yeah, it is very fitting that as we're having this conversation about, soundscapes of everyday life, the train made an appearance.
I hope the editor, when they edit this audio, will keep that little soundbite of the train. So this is I'm appealing to you. So.
Yeah, this is a sensory podcast interview. I'm also wondering, have you thought about how this historical study relates to contemporary everyday life in Egypt and its soundscapes?
Yes, absolutely. You can't really, even as I was writing it, and part of the book was written as I was doing my research in Cairo. And a lot of the tensions that I describe in the book between the state and the street hawkers, for example, is something that is very much ongoing and was always ongoing. I remember distinctly when I was doing even all the way back to my dissertation research, there was always this tension between the state and street hawkers. Even in the used bookstall market in Esbekeya in Cairo, often the state authorities will clamp down and come in because the sellers had these small shacks selling their books, but they weren't allowed to place their books on the sidewalk. The way that they countered some of this enforcement by the state was through cell phones, and almost immediately someone watching out at the police station as they see the undercover officers move towards the bookstalls. Immediately cell phone starts ringing, and then everybody else moves into action. And so there's this cat and mouse game that's ongoing. Also, some of the street hawkers that I describe in the book, they still exist, obviously, in Cairo. Particularly the Roba Bikia seller, and Roba Bikia in colloquial Egyptian is derived from the Italian word Roba Vikia, which means old clothes or old things. The call of the Roba Bikia sellers is still very much prevalent, both in Alexandria and in Cairo. A lot of those realities are still there on the ground. There's still very much class tensions, and there's still very much the middle classes often define themselves using sort of a sensory ways to describe how distinct they are from the working class. So that's something that certainly lives on.
Yeah, and maybe that's a new conversation to be had between, you know, scholars doing sensory work in Egypt right now and, you know, your work and your book. So my last question is about what is next for you? Do you have any new projects or questions in mind? And I don't know if you had, you know, any time to think about this given the current conjuncture, but...
Yes. Well, I actually, I have, because I, in a way, I started doing research for it as I was doing research for this project. So... It also relates to sound somewhat, but it goes back to media, which was my first project where I talked about early media capitalism in Egypt. My next project is going to be on, it will be history of Egyptian radio. So in some ways, it's more traditional in the sense that it'll tell the story about the origins of Egyptian radio. Most likely I'll stop in 1952. So it'll cover from 1925 to the early 50s. I've already started writing. I'm writing an article that's going to be most likely chapter one of this book. That covers the period right before Egyptian state radio, where there was a lot of private radio stations in Egypt. And I pinpointed it, there was probably a dozen or so from 1928 until they were formally shut down by the Egyptian government in May of 1934. The book project will cover this early history, but then it'll focus on early Egyptian state radio from 34 onwards. Surprisingly, there hasn't been really a monograph examining Egyptian radio, despite its importance for a variety of obvious reasons. So in a way, it's connected because sound is a part of it, and I reference radio, obviously. And street sounds, but this will be devoted on Egyptian state radio and its own programming. Hopefully, I will start writing more in full force in my next sabbatical. So, in 300 days.
Sounds great. I'm looking forward to reading that book as well. So thank you very much, Professor Fahmy, for joining us today and for your insights.
Thank you, Aliza. This was truly a pleasure. So,
I'm Aliza Arıcan. This discussion of street sounds, listening to everyday life in modern Egypt, published by Stanford University Press in 2020, is brought to you by the New Books Network in association with the Mobilities and Methods Lab at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Thank you for listening.